staff. Nick has been spared, for now, but of course he feels obliged to take the others out to get drunk. They are men, piled in a cab, heading down 2nd Avenue, pretending to be brave. A few have gone home to their wives, but a surprising number have stayed out. Nick will spend the night of our anniversary buying these men drinks, going to strip clubs and cheesy bars, flirting with 22-year-olds. My friend here just got laid off. He could use a hug. These jobless men will proclaim Nick a great guy as he buys their drinks on a credit card linked to my bank account. Nick will have a grand old time on our anniversary, which he didn't even mention in the message. Instead, he said, I know we had plans, but... I am being a girl. I just thought it'd be a tradition. All across town, I have strewn little love messages, reminders of our past year together, my treasure hunt. I can picture the third clue fluttering from a piece of scotch tape in the crook of the V of the Robert Indiana love sculpture up near Central Park. Tomorrow, some bored 12-year-old tourist stumbling along behind his parents is going to pick it off, read it, shrug, and let it float away like a gum wrapper. My treasure hunt finale was perfect, but isn't now. It's an absolutely gorgeous vintage briefcase. Leather. 3rd anniversary is leather. A work-related gift may be a bad idea, given that work isn't exactly happy right now. In our kitchen, I have 2 live lobsters, like always, or like what was supposed to be like always. I need to phone my mom and see if they can keep for a day, scrambling dazedly around their crate, or if I need to stumble in and with my wine-lame eyes, battle them and boil them in my pot for no good reason. I'm killing 2 lobsters I won't even eat. Dad phoned to wish us happy anniversary, and I picked up the phone and I was going to play it cool, but then I started crying when I started talking. I was doing the awful chick talk cry. Mwahawa, guwaha, and wawa. So I had to tell him what happened, and he told me I should open a bottle of wine and wallow in it for a bit. Dad is always a proponent of a good, indulgent sulk. Still, Nick will be angry that I told Rand, and of course Rand will do his fatherly thing, pat Nick on the shoulder and say, "Heard you had some emergency drinking to do on your anniversary, Nicky," and chuckle. So Nick will know, and he will be angry with me because he wants my parents to believe he's perfect. He beams when I tell them stories about what a flawless son-in-law he is. Except for tonight. I know I'm being a girl. It's 5 a.m. The sun is coming up, almost as bright as the streetlights outside that have just blinked off. I always like that switch, when I'm awake for it. Sometimes, when I can't sleep, I'll pull myself out of bed and walk through the streets at dawn, and when the lights click off all together, I always feel like I've seen something special. Oh, there go the streetlights, I want to announce. In New York, it's not 3 or 4 a.m. that's the quiet time. There are too many bar stragglers calling out to each other as they collapse into taxis, yelping into their cell phones as they frantically smoke that one last cigarette before bed. 5 a.m., that's the best time, when the clicking of your heels on the sidewalk sounds illicit. All the people have been put away in their boxes, and you have the whole place to yourself. Here's what happened. Nick got home just after 4. A bulb of beer and cigarettes and fried egg odor attached to him, a placenta of stink. I was still awake, waiting for him, my brain kathunking after a marathon of law and order. He sat down on our ottoman and glanced at the present on the table and said nothing. I stared at him back. He clearly wasn't going to even graze against an apology. Hey, sorry things got screwy today. That's all I wanted. Just a quick acknowledgement. Happy day after anniversary, I start. He sighs, a deep, aggrieved moan. Amy, I've had the crappiest day ever. Please don't lay a guilt trip on me on top of it. Nick grew up with a father who never, ever apologized. So when Nick feels he is screwed up, he goes on offense. I know this, and I can usually wait it out. Usually. I was just saying happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary, my asshole husband who neglected me on my big day.
We sit silent for a minute, my stomach knotting. I don't want to be the bad guy here. I don't deserve that. Nick stands up.
Well, how was it? I ask dully.
How was it? It was fucking awful. 16 of my friends now have no jobs. It was miserable. I'll probably be gone too another few months.
Friends. He doesn't even like half the guys he was out with. But I say nothing. I know it feels dire right now, Nick, but...
It's not dire for you, Amy. Not for you, it never will be dire. But for the rest of us, it's very different.
The same old. Nick resents that I've never had to worry about money and I never will. He thinks that makes me softer than everyone else, and I wouldn't disagree with him. But I do work. I clock in and clock back out. Some of my girlfriends have literally never had a job. They discuss people with jobs in the pitying tones you talk about a fat girl with such a nice face. They will lean forward and say, "But, of course, Ellen has to work." Like something out of a Noel Coward play. They don't count me, because I can always quit my job if I want to. I could build my days around charity committees and home decoration and gardening and volunteering, and I don't think there's anything wrong with building a life around those things. Most beautiful, good things are done by women people scorn. But I work. Nick, I'm on your side here. We'll be okay no matter what. My money is your money.
Not according to the prenup.
He is drunk. He only mentions the prenup when he's drunk. Then all the resentment comes back. I've told him hundreds, literally hundreds of times I've said the words. The prenup is pure business. It's not for me. It's not even for my parents. It's for my parents' lawyers. It says nothing about us, not you and me. He walks over toward the kitchen, tosses his wallet and wilted dollars on the coffee table, crumples a piece of notepaper and tosses it in the trash with a series of credit card receipts.
That's a shitty thing to say, Nick.
It's a shitty way to feel, Amy.
He walks to our bar, in the careful, swamp-waiting gait of a drunk, and actually pours himself another drink.
You're going to make yourself sick, I say.
He raises his glass in an up-yours cheers to me.
You just don't get it, Amy. You just can't. I've worked since I was 14 years old. I didn't get to go to fucking tennis camp and creative writing camp and SAT prep and all that shit that apparently everyone else in New York City did, because I was wiping down tables at the mall, and I was mowing lawns, and I was driving to Hannibal and fucking dressing like Huck Finn for the tourists, and I was cleaning the funnel cake skillets at midnight.
I feel an urge to laugh, actually to guffaw, a big belly laugh that would sweep up Nick, and soon we'd both be laughing and this would be over. This litany of crummy jobs. Being married to Nick always reminds me, people have to do awful things for money. Ever since I've been married to Nick, I always wave to people dressed as food.
I've had to work so much harder than anyone else at the magazine to even get to the magazine. 20 years, basically, I've been working to get where I am. And now, it's all going to be gone. And there's not a fucking thing I know how to do instead. Unless I want to go back home, be a river rat again.
You're probably too old to play Huck Finn, I say.
Fuck you, Amy.
And then he goes to the bedroom. He's never said that to me before, but it came out of his mouth so smoothly that I assume, and this never crossed my mind, I assume he's thought it many times. I never thought I'd be the kind of woman who'd be told to fuck herself by her husband. And we've sworn never to go to bed angry. Compromise, communicate, and never go to bed angry. The 3 pieces of advice gifted and regifted to all newlyweds. But lately, it seems I am the only one who compromises. Our communications don't solve anything. And Nick is very good at going to bed angry. He can turn off his emotions like a spout. He is already snoring. And then I can't help myself, even though it's none of my business, even though Nick would be furious if he knew. I cross over to the trash can and pull out the receipts so I can picture where he's been all night. 2 bars, 2 strip clubs. And I can see him in each one, talking about me with his friends, because he must have already talked about me for all that petty, smeared meanness to come out so easily. I picture them at one of the pricier strip clubs, the posh ones that make men believe they are still designed to rule, that women are meant to serve them, the deliberately bad acoustics and thwomping music so no one has to talk, a stretch-titted woman straddling my husband, who swears it's all in fun, her hair trailing down her back, her lips wet with gloss. But I'm not supposed to be threatened. No, it's just boyish hijinks. I am supposed to laugh about it. I am supposed to be a good sport. Then I unroll the crumpled piece of notebook paper and see a girl's handwriting, Hannah, and a phone number. I wish it were like the movies, the name something silly, Candy or Bambi, something you could roll your eyes at. Misty, with 2 hearts over the eyes. But it's Hannah, which is a real woman, presumably like me. Nick has never cheated on me. He has sworn it. But I also know he has ample opportunity. I could ask him about Hannah, and he'd say,
I have no idea why she gave me her number, but I didn't want to be rude, so I took it.
Which may be true, or not. He could cheat on me, and he would never tell me, and he would think less and less of me for not figuring it out. He would see me across the breakfast table, innocently slurping cereal, and know that I am a fool. And how can anyone respect a fool? Now I am crying again, with Hannah in my hand. It's a very female thing, isn't it? To take one boy's night and snowball it into a marital infidelity that will destroy our marriage? I don't know what I am supposed to do. I'm feeling like a shrill fishwife or a foolish doormat. I don't know which. I don't want to be angry. I can't even figure out if I should be angry. I consider checking into a hotel. Let him wonder about me for a change. I stay where I am for a few minutes, and then I take a breath and wade into our booze-humid bedroom, and when I get in bed, he turns to me and wraps his arms around me and buries his face in my neck, and at the same time we both say, I'm sorry.
Nick Dunn. One Day Gone. Flashbulbs exploded, and I dropped the smile, but not soon enough. I felt a wave of heat roll up my neck, and beads of sweat broke out on my nose.
Stupid, Nick. Stupid.
And then, just as I was pulling myself together, the press conference was over, and it was too late to make any other impression. I walked out with the Elliots, my head ducked low as more flashbulbs popped. I was almost to the exit when Gilpin trotted across the room toward me, flagging me down.
Can I grab a minute, Nick?
He updated me as we headed toward a back office.
We checked out that house in your neighborhood that was broken into. Looks like people camped out there, so we've got lab there. And we found another house on the edge of your complex. Had some squatters.
I mean, that's what worries me, I said. Guys are camped out everywhere. This whole town is overrun with pissed-off unemployed people. Carthage was, until a year ago, a company town, and that company was the sprawling Riverway Mall, a tiny city unto itself that once employed 4,000 locals, one-fifth the population. It was built in 1985, a destination mall meant to attract shoppers from all over the Middle West. I still remember the opening day, me and Go, Mom and Dad, watching the festivities from the very back of the crowd in the vast tarred parking lot, because our father always wanted to be able to leave quickly from anywhere. Even at baseball games, we parked by the exit and left at the eighth inning, me and Go a predictable set of mustard-smeared wines, petulant and sun-fevered. We never get to see the end. But this time our faraway vantage was desirable, because we got to take in the full scope of the event. The impatient crowd, leaning collectively from one foot to another. The mayor atop a red, white, and blue dais. The booming words, pride, growth, prosperity, success, rolling over us. Soldiers on the battlefield of consumerism, armed with vinyl-covered checkbooks and quilted handbags. And the doors opening. And the rush into the air conditioning. The Muzak. The smiling salespeople who were our neighbors. My father actually let us go inside that day. Actually waited in line and bought us something that day. Sweaty paper cups brimming with orange Julius. For a quarter century, the Riverway Mall was a given. Then the recession hit, washed away the Riverway store by store, until the whole mall finally went bust. It is now 2 million square feet of echo. No company came to claim it. No businessman promised a resurrection. No one knew what to do with it or what would become of all the people who'd worked there, including my mother, who lost her job at Chubby Dooby. 2 decades of kneeling and kneading, of sorting boxes and collecting moist foot hosiery, gone without ceremony. The downfall of the mall basically bankrupted Carthage. People lost their jobs, they lost their houses. No one could see anything good coming anytime soon. We never get to see the end. Except it looked like this time, Go and I would. We all would. The bankruptcy matched my psyche perfectly. For several years, I had been bored. Not a whining, restless child's boredom, although I was not above that, but a dense, blanketing malaise. It seemed to me that there was nothing new to be discovered ever again. Our society was utterly, ruinously derivative, although the word derivative as a criticism is itself derivative. We were the first human beings who would never see anything for the first time. We stare at the wonders of the world, dull-eyed, underwhelmed. Mona Lisa, the pyramids, the Empire State Building, jungle animals on attack. Ancient icebergs collapsing, volcanoes erupting. I can't recall a single amazing thing I have seen firsthand that I didn't immediately reference to a movie or TV show. A fucking commercial. You know the awful sing-song of the blasé, seen it. I've literally seen it all. And the worst thing, the thing that makes me want to blow my brains out is the second-hand experience is always better. The image is crisper, the view is keener, the camera angle and the soundtrack manipulate my emotions in a way reality can't anymore. I don't know that we are actually human at this point, those of us who are like most of us, who grew up with TV and movies and now the internet. If we are betrayed, we know the words to say. When a loved one dies, we know the words to say. If we want to play the stud or the smartass or the fool, we know the words to say. We are all working from the same dog-eared script. It's a very difficult era in which to be a person, just a real, actual person, instead of a collection of personality traits selected from an endless automat of characters. And if all of us are play-acting, there can be no such thing as a soulmate, because we don't have genuine souls. It had gotten to the point where it seemed like nothing matters, because I'm not a real person, and neither is anyone else. I would have done anything to feel real again. Gilpin opened the door to the same room where they'd questioned me the night before. In the center of the table sat Amy's silvery gift box. I stood staring at the box sitting in the middle of the table, so ominous in this new setting. A sense of dread descended on me. Why hadn't I found it before? I should have found it.
"Go ahead," Gilpin said. "We wanted you to take a look at this."
I opened it as gingerly as if a head might be inside. I found only a creamy blue envelope marked First Clue.
Gilpin smirked. "Imagine our confusion. A missing persons case, and here we find an envelope marked First Clue."
"It's for a treasure hunt that my wife..."
"Right, for your anniversary. Your father-in-law mentioned it."
I opened the envelope, pulled out a thick, sky-blue piece of paper, Amy's signature stationery, folded once. Bile crept up my throat. These treasure hunts had always amounted to a single question. Who is Amy? What is my wife thinking? What was important to her this past year? What moments made her happiest? Amy, 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 let's think about Amy. I read the first clue with clenched teeth. Given our marital mood the past year, it was going to make me look awful. I didn't need anything else that made me look awful. "I picture myself as your student, with a teacher so handsome and wise. My mind opens up, not to mention my thighs. If I were your pupil, there'd be no need for flowers, maybe just a naughty appointment during your office hours. So hurry up, get going, please do, and this time I'll teach you a thing or two." It was an itinerary for an alternate life. If things had gone according to my wife's vision, yesterday she would have hovered near me as I read this poem, watching me expectantly, the hope emanating from her like a fever. Please get this. Please get me. And she would finally say, "So?" And I would say, "Oh, I actually know this. She must mean my office at the junior college. I'm an adjunct professor there." "Huh, I mean, it must be, right?" I squinted and reread. "She took it easy on me this year."
"You want me to drive you over?" Gilpin asked.
"Nah, I've got Go's car."
"I'll follow you then."
"You think it's important?"
Well, it shows her movements the day or two before she went missing, so it's not unimportant. He looked at the stationery. It's sweet, you know. Like something out of a movie. A treasure hunt. My wife and I, we give each other a card and maybe get a bite to eat. Sounds like you guys were doing it right. Preserve the romance. Then Gilpin looked at his shoes, got bashful, and jingled his keys to leave. The college had rather grandly presented me with a coffin of an office, big enough for a desk, two chairs, some shelves. Gilpin and I wended our way through the summer school students, a combination of impossibly young kids, bored yet busy, their fingers clicking out texts or dialing up music, and earnest older people I had to assume were mall layoffs, trying to retrain for a new career.
What do you teach? Gilpin asked.
Journalism. Magazine journalism. A girl texting and walking forgot the nuances of the ladder and almost ran into me. She stepped to the side without glancing up. It made me feel cranky, off my lawn, old.
I thought you didn't do journalism anymore.
He who can't do... I smiled. I unlocked my office, stepped into the close-smelling, dust-moated air. I'd taken the summer off. It had been weeks since I'd been here. On my desk sat another envelope, marked Second Clue.
Your key always on your keychain? Gilpin asked.
Yep.
So Amy could have borrowed that to get in?
I tore down the side of the envelope. And we have a spare at home. Amy made doubles of everything. I tended to misplace keys, credit cards, cell phones, but I didn't want to tell Gilpin this. Get another baby of the family jab.
Why? Well, just wanted to make sure she wouldn't have had to go through, I don't know, a janitor or someone.
No Freddy Krueger types here that I've noticed.
Never saw those movies, Gilpin replied.
Inside the envelope were two folded slips of paper. One was marked with a heart. The other was labeled Clue. Two notes. Different. My stomach clenched. God knew what Amy was going to say. I opened the note with the heart. I wished I hadn't let Gilpin come. And then I caught the first words. My darling husband, I figured this was the perfect place, these hallowed halls of learning, to tell you I think you are a brilliant man. I don't tell you enough, but I am amazed by your mind, the weird statistics and anecdotes, the strange facts, the disturbing ability to quote from any movie, the quick wit, the beautiful way you have of wording things. After years together, I think a couple can forget how wonderful they find each other. I remember when we first met, how dazzled I was by you, and so I want to take a moment to tell you I still am, and it's one of my favorite things about you. You are brilliant. My mouth watered. Gilpin was reading over my shoulder, and he actually sighed.
Sweet lady, he said.
Then he cleared his throat.
These yours?
He used the eraser end of a pencil to pick up a pair of women's underwear. Technically, they were panties. Stringy, lacy, red. But I know women get creeped out by that word. Just Google hate the word panties. They'd been hanging off a knob on the AC unit.
Oh, jeez. That's embarrassing.
Gilpin waited for an explanation.
One time Amy and I, well, you read her note. We kinda, you know. You sometimes gotta spice things up a little.
Gilpin grinned.
Oh, I get it. Randy professor and naughty student. I get it. You two really were doing it right.
I reached for the underwear, but Gilpin was already producing an evidence bag from his pocket and sliding them in.
Just a precaution, he said inexplicably.
Oh, please don't, I said. Amy would die. I caught myself.
Don't worry, Nick. It's all protocol, my friend. You wouldn't believe the hoops we gotta jump through. Just in case, just in case. Ridiculous.
What's the clue say? I let him read over my shoulder again, his jarringly fresh smell distracting me.
So what's that one mean? He asked.
I have no idea. I lied. I finally rid myself of Gilpin, then drove aimlessly down the highway so I could make a call on my disposable. No pickup. I didn't leave a message. I sped for a while longer, as if I could get anywhere. Then I turned around and drove the 45 minutes back toward town to meet the Elliots at the Days Inn. I walked into a lobby packed with members of the Midwest Payroll Vendors Association, wheelie bags parked everywhere, their owners slurping complimentary drinks in small plastic cups and networking, forced guttural laughs, and pockets fished for business cards. I rode up the elevator with 4 men, all balding and khakied and golf-shirted, lanyards bouncing off round married bellies. Mary Beth opened the door while talking on her cell phone. She pointed toward the TV and whispered to me, "We have a cold cut tray if you want, sweetheart." Then went into the bathroom and closed the door, her murmurs continuing. She emerged a few minutes later, just in time for the local 5 o'clock news from St. Louis, which led with Amy's disappearance.
"Perfect photo," Mary Beth murmured at the screen, where Amy peered back at us. "People will see it and really know what Amy looks like."
I'd thought the portrait, a headshot from Amy's brief fling with acting, beautiful but unsettling. Amy's pictures gave a sense of her actually watching you, like an old-time haunted house portrait, the eyes moving from left to right.
"We should get them some candid photos, too," I said. "Some everyday ones."
The Elliots nodded in tandem but said nothing, watching. When the spot was done, Rand broke the silence.
"I feel sick."
"I know," Mary Beth said.
"How are you holding up, Nick?"
Rand asked, hunched over, hands on both knees, as if he were preparing to get up from the sofa, but couldn't quite do it.
"I'm a goddamn mess, to tell the truth. I feel so useless." "You know, I gotta ask, what about your employees, Nick?"
Rand finally stood. He went to the minibar, poured himself a ginger ale, then turned to me and Mary Beth.
"Anyone? Something? Anything?"
I shook my head. Mary Beth asked for a club soda.
"Want some gin with it too, babe?"
Rand asked, his deep voice going high on the final word.
"Sure. Yes, I do."
Mary Beth closed her eyes, bent in half, and brought her face between her knees. Then she took a deep breath and sat back up in her exact previous position, as if it were all a yoga exercise. "I gave them lists of everyone," I said. "But it's a pretty tame business, Rand. I just don't think that's the place to look." Rand put a hand across his mouth and rubbed upward, the flesh of his cheeks bunching up around his eyes.
"Of course, we're doing the same with our business, Nick."
Rand and Mary Beth always referred to the Amazing Amy series as a business, which on the surface never failed to strike me as silly, They are children's books about a perfect little girl who's pictured on every book cover. A cartoonish version of my own Amy. But of course they were, a business, big business. They were elementary school staples for the better part of 2 decades, largely because of the quizzes at the end of every chapter. In 3rd grade, for instance, Amazing Amy caught her friend Brian overfeeding the class turtle. She tried to reason with him, but when Brian persisted in the extra helpings, Amy had no choice but to narc on him to her teacher.
"Mrs. Tibbles, I don't want to be a tattletale, but I'm not sure what to do. I've tried talking to Brian myself, but now I guess I might need help from a grown-up."
The fallout. 1. Brian told Amy she was an untrustworthy friend and stopped talking to her. 2. Her timid pal Susie said Amy shouldn't have told. She should have secretly fished out the food without Brian knowing. 3. Amy's arch-rival, Joanna, said Amy was jealous and just wanted to feed the turtle herself. 4. Amy refused to back down. She felt she did the proper thing.
Who is right?
Well, that's easy, because Amy is always right in every story. Don't think I haven't brought this up in my arguments with my real Amy, because I have more than once. The quizzes, written by 2 psychologists who are also parents like you, were supposed to tease out a child's personality traits. Is your wee one a sulker who can't stand to be corrected, like Brian? A spineless enabler, like Susie? A pot stirrer, like Joanna? Or perfect, like Amy? The books became extremely trendy among the rising yuppie class. They were the pet rock of parenting. The Rubik's Cube of child-rearing. The Elliots got rich. At one point, it was estimated that every school library in America had an Amazing Amy book. "Do you have worries that this might link back to the Amazing Amy business?" I asked.
"We do have a few people we thought might be worth checking out," Rand began.
I coughed out a laugh.
"Do you think Judith Viorst kidnapped Amy for Alexander so he wouldn't have any more terrible, horrible, no-good, very bad days?"
Rand and Mary Beth turned matching, surprised, disappointed faces toward me. It was a gross, tasteless thing to say. My brain had been burping up such inappropriate thoughts at inopportune moments. Mental gas I couldn't control. Like I'd started internally singing the lyrics to Boney Maroney whenever I saw my cop friend. "She's as skinny as a stick of macaroni," my brain would bebop as Detective Rhonda Boney was telling me about dragging the river for my missing wife. "Defense mechanism," I told myself. "Just a weird defense mechanism. I'd like it to stop." I rearranged my leg delicately, spoke delicately, as if my words were an unwieldy stack of fine china. "I'm sorry. I don't know why I said that."
"We're all tired," Rand offered.
"We'll have the cops round up Viorst," Mary Beth tried. "And that bitch Beverly Cleary, too."
It was less a joke than a pardon. "I guess I should tell you," I said. "The cops, it's normal in this kind of case."
"To look at the husband first, I know," Rand interrupted. "I told them they're wasting their time. The questions they asked us."
"They were offensive," Mary Beth finished.
"So they have spoken with you? About me?" I moved over to the minibar, casually poured a gin. I swallowed 3 belts in a row and felt immediately worse. My stomach was working its way up my esophagus.
"What kind of stuff did they ask?" "Have you ever hurt Amy? Has Amy ever mentioned you threatening her?"
Mary Beth ticked off.
"Are you a womanizer?
Has Amy ever mentioned you cheating on her? Because that sounds like Amy, right? I told them we didn't raise a doormat.
Rand put a hand on my shoulder. Nick, what we should have said, first of all, is we know you would never, ever hurt Amy. I even told the police, told them the story about you saving the mouse at the beach house, saving it from the glue trap.
He looked over at Mary Beth as if she didn't know the story, and Mary Beth obliged with her rapt attention.
Spent an hour trying to corner the damn thing, and then literally drove the little rat bastard out of town. Does that sound like a guy who had hurt his wife?
I felt a burst of intense guilt, self-loathing. I thought for a second I might cry, finally.
We love you, Nick, Rand said, giving me a final squeeze.
We do, Nick, Mary Beth echoed. You're our son. We are so incredibly sorry that on top of Amy being gone, you have to deal with this cloud of suspicion.
I didn't like the phrase cloud of suspicion. I much preferred routine investigation or a mere formality.
They did wonder about your restaurant reservations that night, Mary Beth said, an overly casual glance.
My reservations?
They said you told them you had reservations at Houston's, but they checked it out, and there were no reservations. They seemed really interested in that.
I had no reservation, and I had no gift. Because if I planned on killing Amy that day, I wouldn't have needed reservations for that night, or a gift I'd never need to give her. The hallmarks of an extremely pragmatic killer.
I am pragmatic to a fault. My friends could certainly tell the police that.
No, I never made reservations. They must have misunderstood me. I'll let them know.
I collapsed on the couch across from Mary Beth. I didn't want Rand to touch me again.
Oh, okay. Good, Mary Beth said. Did you get a treasure hunt this year?
Her eyes turned red again.
Before?
Yeah, they gave me the first clue today. Gilpin and I found the second one in my office at the college. I'm still trying to figure it out.
Can we take a look?
My mother-in-law asked.
I don't have it with me, I lied.
Will you try to solve it, Nick?
Mary Beth asked.
I will, Mary Beth. I'll solve it.
I just hate the idea of things she touched, left out there, all alone.
My phone rang, the disposable, and I flicked a glance at the display, then shut it off.
I needed to get rid of the thing, but I couldn't yet.
You should pick up every call, Nick, Mary Beth said. I recognized this one. Just my college alum fund looking for money.
Rand sat beside me on the couch. The ancient, much-abused cushions sank severely under our weight, so we ended up pushed toward each other, arms touching, which was fine with Rand.
He was one of those guys who'd pronounce, "I'm a hugger," as he came at you, neglecting to ask if the feeling was mutual.
Mary Beth returned to business.
We do think it's possible an Amy obsessive took her.
She turned to me, as if pleading a case.
We've had him over the years.
Amy had been fond of recollecting stories of men obsessed with her. She described the stalkers in hushed tones over glasses of wine at various periods during our marriage. Men who were still out there, always thinking about her and wanting her. I suspected these stories were inflated. The men always came off as dangerous to a very precise degree. Enough for me to worry about, but not enough to require us to involve the police. In short, a play world where I could be Amy's chest-puffed hero, defending her honor. Amy was too independent, too modern,
to be able to admit the truth. She wanted to play damsel.
Lately?
Not lately, no, Mary Beth said, chewing her lip. But there was a very disturbed girl back in high school.
Disturbed how?
She was obsessed with Amy. Well, with amazing Amy. Her name was Hilary Handy. She modeled herself after Amy's best friend in the books, Susie. At first it was cute, I guess, and then it was like that wasn't good enough anymore. She wanted to be Amazing Amy, not Susie the sidekick. So she began imitating our Amy. She dressed like Amy. She colored her hair blonde. She'd linger outside our house in New York. One time I was walking down the street and she came running up to me, this strange girl, and she looped her arm through mine and said, "I'm going to be your daughter now. I'm going to kill Amy and be your new Amy. Because it doesn't really matter to you, does it? As long as you have an Amy. Like our daughter was a piece of fiction she could rewrite."
We finally got a restraining order because she threw Amy down a flight of stairs at school, Rand said. Very disturbed girl. That kind of mentality doesn't go away.
And then Desi, Mary Beth said.
And Desi, Rand said.
Even I knew about Desi. Amy had attended a Massachusetts boarding school called Wickshire Academy. I had seen the photos, Amy in lacrosse skirts and headbands, always with autumn colors in the background, as if the school were based not in a town, but in a month. October. Desi Collings attended the boys' boarding school that was paired with Wickshire. In Amy's stories, he was a pale, romantic figure, and their courtship had been of the boarding school variety. Chilly football games and overheated dances, lilac corsages and rides in a vintage Jaguar. Everything a little bit mid-century. Amy dated Desi quite seriously for a year, but she began to find him alarming. He talked as if they were engaged. He knew the number and gender of their children. They were going to have 4 kids, all boys, which sounded suspiciously like Desi's own family. And when he brought his mother down to meet her, Amy grew queasy at the striking resemblance between herself and Mrs. Collings. The older woman had kissed her cheek coldly and murmured calmly in her ear, "Good luck." Amy couldn't tell if it was a warning or a threat. After Amy cut it off with Desi, he still lingered around the Wickshire campus, a ghostly figure in dark blazers, leaning against wintry, leafless oak trees. Amy returned from a dance one February night to find him lying on her bed, naked, on top of the covers, groggy from a very marginal pill overdose. Desi left school shortly after. But he still phoned her. Even now, and several times a year sent her thick, padded envelopes that Amy tossed unopened after showing them to me. They were postmarked St. Louis, 40 minutes away. "It's just a horrible, miserable coincidence," she'd told me. Desi had the St. Louis family connections on his mother's side. This much she knew, but didn't care to know more. I'd picked through the trash to retrieve one, read the letter, sticky with Alfredo sauce, and it had been utterly banal. Talk of tennis and travel and other things preppy. Spaniels. I tried to picture this slender dandy, a fellow in bow ties and tortoiseshell glasses, busting into our house and grabbing Amy with soft, manicured fingers, tossing her in the trunk of his vintage roadster and taking her antiquing in Vermont. Desi. Could anyone believe it was Desi? "Desi lives not far away, actually," I said. "St. Louis." "Now, see?" Rand said. "Why are the cops not all over this?" "Someone needs to be," I said.
I'll go. After the search here tomorrow.
The police definitely seem to think it's close to home, Mary Beth said. She kept her eyes on me one beat too long, then shivered, as if shaking off a thought.
Amy Elliott Dunn, August 23rd, 2010. Diary entry. Summer. Birdies. Sunshine. I spent today shuffling around Prospect Park, my skin tender, my bones brittle. Misery battling. It is an improvement since I spent the previous 3 days in our house, in the same crusty pajama set, marking time until 5 when I could have a drink. Trying to make myself remember the suffering in Darfur, put things into perspective, which I guess is just further exploiting the people of Darfur. So much has unraveled the past week. I think that's what it is, that it's all happened at once, so I have the emotional bends. Nick lost his job a month ago. The recession is supposed to be winding down, but no one seems to know that. So Nick lost his job. Second round of layoffs, just like he predicted. Just a few weeks after the first round. Oops, we didn't fire nearly enough people. Idiots. At first, I think Nick might be okay. He makes a massive list of things he's always meant to do. Some of it's tiny stuff. He changes watch batteries and resets clocks. He replaces a pipe beneath our sink and repaints all the rooms we painted before and didn't like. Basically, he does a lot of things over. It's nice to take some actual do-overs when you get so few in life. And then he starts on bigger stuff. He reads War and Peace. He flirts with taking Arabic lessons. He spends a lot of time trying to guess what skills will be marketable over the next few decades. It breaks my heart, but I pretend it doesn't for his sake. I keep asking him, "Are you sure you're okay?" At first, I try it seriously, over coffee, eye contact, my hand on his. Then I try it breezily, lightly, in passing. Then I try it tenderly, in bed, stroking his hair. He has the same answer always.
"I'm fine. I don't really want to talk about it."
I wrote a quiz that was perfect for the times. How are you handling your layoff? A. I sit in my pajamas and eat a lot of ice cream. Sulking is therapeutic. B. I write nasty things about my old boss online, everywhere. Venting feels great. C. Until a new job comes along, I try to find useful things to do with my newfound time, like learning a marketable language or finally reading War and Peace. It was a compliment to Nick. C was the correct answer, but he just gave a sour smile when I showed it to him. A few weeks in, the bustling stopped, the usefulness stopped, as if he woke up one morning under a decrepit, dusty sign that read, "Why fucking bother?" He went dull-eyed. Now he watches TV, surfs porn, watches porn on TV. He eats a lot of delivery food, the styrofoam shells propped up near the overflowing trash can. He doesn't talk to me. He behaves as if the act of talking physically pains him, and I am a vicious woman to ask it of him. He barely shrugs when I tell him I was laid off. Last week.
"That's awful. I'm sorry," he says. "At least you have your money to fall back on."
We have the money. I liked my job, though. He starts singing "You Can't Always Get What You Want," off-key, high-pitched, with a little stumbling dance, and I realize he is drunk. It is late afternoon, a beautiful blue, blue day, and our house is dank, thick with the sweet smell of rotting Chinese food, the curtains all drawn over, and I begin walking room to room to air it out, pulling back the drapes, scaring the dust motes. And when I reach the darkened den, I stumble over a bag on the floor, and then another and another, like the cartoon cat who walks into a room full of mouse traps. When I switch on the lights, I see dozens of shopping bags, and they are from places laid-off people don't go. They are the high-end men's stores, the places that hand-tailor suits, where salespeople carry ties individually, draped over an arm, to male shoppers nestled in leather armchairs. I mean, the shit is bespoke.
What is all this, Nick?
For job interviews, if anyone ever starts hiring again.
You need it so much?
We do have the money.
He smiles at me grimly, his arms crossed.
Do you at least want to hang them up?
Several of the plastic coverings have been chewed apart by Bleaker. A tiny mound of cat vomit lays near one $3,000 suit. A tailored white shirt is covered in orange fur where the cat has napped.
Not really. Nope,
he said. He grins at me. I have never been a nag. I have always been rather proud of my unnagginess. So it pisses me off that Nick is forcing me to nag. I am willing to live with a certain amount of sloppiness, of laziness, of the lackadaisical life. I realize that I am more type A than Nick, and I try to be careful not to inflict my neat, freaky, to-do list nature on him. Nick is not the kind of guy who is going to think to vacuum or clean out the fridge. He truly doesn't see that kind of stuff. Fine, really. But I do like a certain standard of living. I think it's fair to say the garbage shouldn't literally overflow, and the plates shouldn't sit in the sink for a week with smears of bean burrito dried on them. That's just being a good, grown-up roommate. And Nick's not doing anything anymore, so I have to nag, and it pisses me off. You are turning me into what I never have been and never wanted to be, a nag, because you are not living up to your end of a very basic compact. Don't do that. It's not okay to do. I know that losing a job is incredibly stressful, and particularly for a man. They say it can be like a death in the family, and especially for a man like Nick, who has always worked. So I take a giant breath, roll my anger up into a red rubber ball, and mentally kick it out into space. Well, do you mind if I hang these up? Just so they stay nice for you?
Knock yourself out.
His and her layoffs. Isn't that sweet? I know we are luckier than most. I go online and check my trust fund whenever I get nervous. I never called it a trust fund before Nick did. It's actually not that grand. I mean, it's nice. It's great. $785,404 that I have in savings thanks to my parents. But it's not the kind of money that allows you to stop working forever, especially not in New York. My parents' whole point was to make me feel secure enough so I didn't need to make choices based on money, in schooling, in career, but not so well off that I could be tempted to check out. Nick makes fun, but I think it's a great gesture for parents to make. And appropriate, considering they plagiarized my childhood for the books. But I'm still feeling sick about the layoff, our layoffs, when my dad calls and asks if he and Mom can stop by. They need to talk with us. This afternoon. Now, actually, if it's okay. Of course it's okay, I say, and in my head I think, cancer, cancer, cancer. My parents appear at the door, looking like they've put up an effort. My father is thoroughly pressed and tucked and shined, impeccable except for the grooves beneath his eyes. My mother is in one of her bright purple dresses that she always wore to speeches and ceremonies, back when she got those invitations. She says the color demands confidence of the wearer. They look great, but they seem ashamed. I usher them to the sofa, and we all sit silently for a second.
Kids, your mother and I, we seem to have...
My father finally starts, then stops.